Two reasons. One is my voice carries, and secondly, I was usually talking. Good morning. Glad you're back. Hope everybody had a restful night. And we're ready for the second day. And we're going to start off with the piece de resistance. We're going to have Dr. Norman Geisler. And Dr. Geisler is, I think, without argument. Certainly, I would argue with anyone who disagreed. Dr. Geisler is the preeminent apologist for the Christian faith in the last third of the 20th century and the first third of the 21st century. And Dr. Geisler is a gift to the church at a time when we have desperately needed his gifts. And Southern Evangelical Seminary is dedicated to preserving and perpetuating the Geislerian DNA. I'm a Texan, so I'll use a Texas analogy. When the Anglos came into Texas in the 1820s, there were about 500,000 wild cattle called longhorns that had descended from some cattle that the Spanish lost when they came to Texas and then left. And so when the Anglos saw these cattle, they said, wow, dinner. And so they killed about 470,000 of them and barbecued them. Finally, somebody said, you know, we probably ought to keep some of these things around. And so they did, and they discovered that the longhorn is a genetic gold mine because they had to survive without human help for a couple of hundred years. And so they have, they're virtually impervious to disease. They can have a calf and just keep right on walking. And they have 2% lean meat. And so they have used the longhorns, they've brought them back, and they've cross-breeded them with other crossbred them, I guess, with other cattle to improve the genetics of the other cattle breeds. And so Dr. Geisler is our longhorn. And SES is committed to perpetuating and propagating the Geislerian DNA back into the Christian church in all of its various manifestations. And I don't want to take any more of his time. Dr. Geisler, you come and share with us.
Good morning. I see we got the early birds anyway here today. I'd like you to meet the better half of our family, my wife Barbara. Would you stand up, please, in the aisle back there? We've been married for 62 years. I was 5, or somewhere thereabouts. It's great to be with you. It's really great to be here. In fact, come to think of it, it's great to be anywhere. This is my 50th year of teaching apologetics, so I had a chance to share around the world. We've been in 48 states and about 60 countries sharing apologetics and teaching people to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints. We live in a strange world. It's called the postmodern world, and most people haven't caught up with the modern world, and we're talking about the postmodern world. And I would like to talk about how to defend the faith in this postmodern world. There's an apologist by the name of Penner who said, I suggest that modern Christian apologetics subtly undermines the very gospel it seeks to defend. Apologetics itself might be the single biggest threat to genuine Christian faith that we face today. Not only can apologetics curse, it actually is a curse. That's a view of a post-modern person. Apologetics is a curse to our generation. I'd like to suggest this morning that that's not true, and I'll give you reasons why we believe that post-apologetics in the postmodern world is not itself working. I want to cover 4 points. What is postmodernism? How to defend against it? What are first principles of knowledge that help us defend against it? And what's wrong with the postmodern world? First of all, what is postmodernism? Postmodernism is a view that has emerged recently. The pre-modernism is what happened before 1650, roughly, where the stress was on reality, metaphysics. Modernism, which existed about from 1650 to 1950, that's the year I graduated from high school, is the modern world. There the stress was on epistemology. How can we know? Postmodernism, from roughly 1950 to the present, roughly the end of the Second World War to the present time. And the stress has been on interpretation, hermeneutics. So there's been a different emphasis in the different periods, and I'd like to stress, of course, that last one, postmodernism. You can illustrate the difference between the various views, illustration by an umpire. In the pre-modern world, the umpire used to say, "I call them like they are." In modern world, the umpire said, "I call them like I see them." In the postmodern world, an umpire says, "They ain't nothing till I call them." You can see that there's a radical difference in the pre- and postmodern worlds. And the radical difference is going to come out in something called relativism. According to postmodernism, modernism, or modernity, as it's called, is dead. Just forget about it. In fact, I saw a bug just like that a couple of days ago. On its back, you know it's dead when it's on its back and not moving. There are a number of forerunners of postmodernism. David Hume, who died in 1776, famous Scottish skeptic. Radical empiricism. You can only know what your five senses tell you, the empirical world. Radical empiricism. Immanuel Kant, who was the first great agnostic, who said you just can't know, Kant's agnosticism, and his agnosticism set stage for the modern world. Soren Kierkegaard, the French, existentialist, who set the stage by teaching the philosophy of existentialism. Friedrich Nietzsche, a famous atheist, who died in the year 1900, which gives you an idea of exactly where we are in the modern world. Nietzsche, who taught atheism. Derrida, who is kind of one of the fathers of the postmodern world, in a view called deconstructionism. Here's a history of the modern world. If you haven't studied this, then you need to get a hold of this volume. We wrote a two-volume set called The History of Philosophy, and volume two is The Modern and Postmodern World, from Descartes to Derrida. René Descartes is credited with being the father of modernism. He was the one that said, "I think, therefore I am." Actually, he got it in reverse. It should have been, "I am, therefore I think." He kind of caught the cart before the horse. I realize it's early for any joke, but that's the best I had to offer. What is postmodernism? Who are the forerunners of it? And how do we contrast postmodernism with the modern world? How can you tell that you've moved from modernity to postmodernity? Well, first of all, modern thought stressed the unity of the mind and the unity of thought, where postmodern thought stresses diversity of thought. In the modern world, they stress the rational. In the postmodern world, social and psychological. In the modern world, there is a stress on the conceptual. In the postmodern world, on the visual and poetical. In the modern world, truth was absolute. In the postmodern world, truth is relative. In the modern world, they taught exclusivism, whereas the postmodern world, the emphasis is on pluralism. In the modern world, there were two forms of foundationalism, that there was foundational doctrines, fundamental foundational doctrines that you could rest your thought on. But postmodernism is anti-foundationalism. There are no foundational doctrines. In the modern world, the emphasis was on epistemology, how we know. Postmodern world, it's on hermeneutics, how do we interpret things. In the modern world, there was a quest for certainty. How can we know things for sure? In the postmodern world, there's a stress on uncertainty. There is no certainty. In the modern world, they sought to find out the author's meaning, what the author meant by a term. In the postmodern world, they're looking for the reader's meaning. What is it they're looking for? Well, truth. What's truth? Truth is story unfolding, not a tale already told. The journey is what counts, and not the destination. Postmodernism. God is dead. It's a condition that anything is possible and nothing is certain. And that's the world in which you and I live. Really starts with the death of Nietzsche in a very special way. Friedrich Nietzsche, the atheist who said, "God is dead." God remains dead. He didn't just die, he remains dead. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? From Nietzsche's book, The Madman. So God is dead is kind of the basis for postmodern thought. But God is dead in different ways in different spheres. Epistemology, how we know. God is dead epistemologically. That would be Immanuel Kant, though he personally believed in a deistic God. Nonetheless, he believed that you cannot know this God with your mind. Mythologically, God is dead mythologically. Nietzsche, the myth of God died. We died with him. Or God is dead dialectically. Hegel, a famous philosopher who is credited with starting a dialectic, and Altizer, his disciple, who had taken this into extreme. Or God could be dead linguistically. A.J. Ayer, Language, Truth, and Logic, who said that God is dead linguistically. We cannot know the meaning of terms. Or God can be dead phenomenologically. Husserl, the great philosopher of phenomenology. Or God is dead existentially. Jean-Paul Sartre, famous French existentialist. Or God is dead cognitively. There is no cognitive knowledge of God. Wittgenstein, you can always tell whether somebody actually knew and read these philosophers or not. If they say Wittgenstein, you know you're in trouble. It's Wittgenstein. Or God is dead hermeneutically. Heidegger and Derrida. But God is dead one way or the other. Note, many of these also believe that God is dead actually. But all of them believe in the death of God. The death of God is either epistemological, mythological, dialectical, linguistic, phenomenological, existential, cognitively, or hermeneutically. But God is dead is the characteristic of this new modernism. Jacques Derrida, postmodernism, French Jew. There is no fixed objective meaning or truth in a text. Every text can be deconstructed and reconstructed. It can mean many things, many times. In fact, every time it is read or said, it changes its meaning. Or Foucault, influenced by Kant, Nietzsche, and Husserl, died of AIDS at age 58. He wrote Madness and Civilization, The Order of Things, stressing the death of God in the 20th century. So what's the result of postmodernism? In a single word, if you want to understand what's going on in the world today, it's relativism. Relativism. If there is no absolute mind, then there is no absolute truth. Follows, if God died and the mind died, then absolute truth dies with an absolute mind. There's no absolute meaning. Semantical relativism. Well, of course, if there's no absolute mind, no absolute, there's no absolute meaning, because minds can mean things. There's no absolute history, so we have to reconstruct history, reconstructionism. If there is no absolute author, the author died, then there's no absolute writing, textual relativism. Every text means something different. Or no absolute interpretation. How can you be absolutely sure if there's no absolute meaning to any text? If there's no absolute thinker, then there is no absolute thought. Doesn't take a genius to figure that out. There's no absolute laws of thought. Foundationalism, which we'll say a great deal about in a moment. There's no absolute laws of thought, and there's no absolute thought itself. If there's no absolute purposer, then there is no absolute purpose. Teleological, from the Greek word telos, or end or design. Teleological relativism. If there's no absolute God, then there is no absolute right or wrong, because if you don't have an absolute moral lawgiver, you cannot have an absolute moral law. So you and I live in the postmodern world, which is characterized by relativism. Relativism on every level, whether it's relativism of truth, of meaning, of history, of writing, of interpretation, of thought, of the laws of thought. There's no absolute purpose, no absolute good, and no absolute God. Objectivity doesn't exist. All absolutes died without God and the future life. How will man be after that? It means everything is permitted now. Everything is permitted. The brothers Karamazov, in the famous book by Dostoevsky, pretty well sums it up. Without God and the future life, how will man be after that? It means that everything is permitted. No moral lawgiver, no moral laws. Jean-Paul Sartre said, I knew myself alone, utterly alone, in the midst of this well-meaning little universe of yours. I was like a man who lost his shadow, and there was nothing left in heaven, and no right or no wrong, nor anyone to give him orders. And No Exit in three other plays by Jean-Paul Sartre. That's it in a nutshell. A lonely life where there is no right or wrong, no one to give any orders. Aldous Huxley said, the liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. There are hardly any scholars who are more honest than Huxley in that Brave New World. So the Brave New World of postmodernism is one where there's no absolutes, no absolute right or wrong, no absolute truth and falsity. What is postmodernism? The root, atheism. The fruit, relativism. Relativism in every area. Secondly, how to defend against postmodernism. The definition. Foundationalism, the view that there are fundamental or foundational principles, first principles, as the basis of all knowledge. In order to defend against against the new modernism, the postmodernism, we have to defend foundationalism. What is foundationalism? The view that there are fundamental, self-evident first principles, the basis of all knowledge. Foundational truth is based in these first principles. Postmodernism, there are no self-evident first principles of knowledge, and therefore we can't know anything for sure. Distinction. There are two kinds of foundationalism. One is called deductive foundationalism, and one is called reductive. Deductive foundationalism is rejected. A statement, all truths are deducible from self-evident first principles. This is a geometric. You have axioms, and from these axioms you can deduce all knowledge. Spinoza claim. All truths are deducible from self-evident first principles. Proponents of that view, Spinoza and Descartes. Reductive foundationalism is different. Statements, all truths are reducible to the self-evident first principles, not deducible from them, like in geometry, but reducible. Proponent of this view is Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas lived from around 1224, 1225, to 1274. He was one of the greatest thinkers of all time. And we think highly of Thomas Aquinas because of his philosophy and because of what it provides for us, an answer to postmodernism and an answer for certainty in the modern world. Deductive foundationalism operates like Euclidean geometry, based on self-evident axioms. Parallel lines never meet in infinity, for example. It deduces all truth from these axioms. The problem with the deductive foundationalism, and a lot of people reject it, is not all axioms are necessary. There are different axioms that are possible. In some forms of geometry, parallel lines meet in infinity. Riemannian, for example. Necessary axioms are empty, even if there were necessary first principles. They're empty principles. They yield no knowledge about reality. For example, all triangles have three sides. Does not tell us there are any triangles. It says, if there is a triangle, it must have three sides. Empty knowledge. All husbands are married men. Does not tell us that there are any husbands. It just says, if there is a husband, he must be a married man. So we, along with the modern world, reject deductive foundationalism. But while we reject that, we accept a reductive foundationalism, such as Thomas Aquinas held. Every statement, not evident in itself, must be evident in terms of something else. You can reduce all knowledge to first principles. But there can't be an infinite regress of non-evident statements. And since there can't be an infinite regress of non-evident statements, there must be a first self-evident principles. And so there must be a first self-evident statements in terms of which non-evident statements are made known to be true. So we're going to defend reductive foundationalism as the basis for knowledge, as the basis for answering the new modernism. An endless regress of explanations. An attempt to explain away the need for explanation. If you had an endless regress of statements, you would explain away explanation itself. C.S. Lewis said there's a need for first principles. You cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on and seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something itself. A first principles of knowledge. That statement by C.S. Lewis in the book, The Abolition of Man, makes clear what you and I believe about knowledge. Knowledge is possible. Knowledge is knowable. Knowledge is absolute because it can be reduced to first self-evident principles, which are undeniable. Reductive foundationalism. Well, what are first principles? If knowledge is possible because of first principles, what are the first principles on which we can base our certain knowledge? First principles defined in a reductive view. Self-evident statement. A statement where the predicate term is reducible to the subject term. Every contingent being has a cause. Now, that isn't obviously self-evident, but it is reduced to the self-evident. The contingent means could not be. Contingent is something that is, but might not be. But non-being can't cause being. Hence, every contingent being has a cause. The reason that you and I can be certain about the principle, say, for example, of causality, is it's reducible to a first principle. A contingent being means what could not be, but non-being cannot cause being. Hence, every contingent being has a cause. Here are some first principles. Now, this is why, once you understand these first principles, this is why you and I believe that we can know things for sure, that we can prove certain things, because of certain first principles which are self-evident. First one we call the law of existence. Being is. Something exists. That's self-evident, that something exists. It's a law of existence. Without that first principle, you can't know anything. Principle number two, the law of identity. Being is being. Be is be. Being is being. It's a first principle. Can't deny it without affirming it. Three, the law of non-contradiction. Being is not non-being. Be is not non-be. The law of non-contradiction is one of the three fundamental laws of thought that are literally undeniable. Four, the law of excluded middle. Either being or non-being. Either be or not be. But not both. Or another first principle of knowledge, the law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. Nothing can't cause something. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. Even Julie Andrews understood this one. The law of causality. Or five, the law of analogy. An effect is similar to its efficient cause. An effect is similar to its efficient cause. Seven. Therefore, there exists, that is, a first cause of the existence that is similar to its effect. Now notice, just taking the six basic laws themselves, all of which are self-evident, you can get certain knowledge. You can be sure of the conclusion. Because if being is, and being is being, and being is not non-being, and it's either being or non-being, and non-being cannot cause being, and an effect is similar to its efficient cause, then God must exist. God exists. The first uncaused cause of all that exists is similar to its effect. What is postmodernism? It's relativism. What is foundationalism? There are foundational first principles. What's wrong with postmodernism? Three things. And you can see a lot of modern apologetics comes out of these principles. Why do we believe in first principles? Because you can't think, can't be thought consistently without them. Because you can't speak, you can't be spoken consistently without them. It can't be believed consistently. And different forms of apologetics have emerged from these principles. They're all true. And all of those apologetic systems are accurate. Let's take them one by one. Can't be thought consistently without first principles. Can't be spoken. And it can't be lived. Thomas Aquinas, who lived in 1225, as we said, 1274, said, if there were an infinite regress in demonstration, it would be impossible because the conclusion of any demonstration is made certain by the reducing of to first principles of demonstration in commentary on metaphysics. The only way we can be sure of something is by knowing that these first principles exist and what we're saying is reducible to. Not deducible from, but reducible to these first principles. It can't be thought consistently without these first principles. Every attempt to deny first principles uses them in the very denial. For example, nothing exists implies something exists, namely the person who's denying it. So to say nothing exists is a self-defeating statement. You have to exist in order to say something doesn't exist. Or being is not being. Assumes the term being is identical to itself. Otherwise, the negation of it would not be of the same thing. Being is not non-being. Nothing exists is self-defeating. Contradictories can both be true. It assumes that that contradictions of that statement can be true. So it can't be thought. You can't even think rational thoughts without using first principles of knowledge. Let me put it in simple language. The statement, I don't exist. Well then, who said that? If I don't exist, who was it that said, I don't exist? It's a self-defeating statement. Or opposites can both be true. It's a self-defeating statement. Is the opposite of that true? Opposites can both be true? Can the opposite of that statement be true? Clearly not. Not only can you not state these principles, you can't think them consistently. Every attempt to deny first principles of knowledge uses them in the very denial. What's the relation between logic and the laws of thought. Well, ontologically, in the order of being, the basis for logic follows from its rational nature. If there is a rational being who therefore has a rational nature, then there must be a rational basis for that being existence. Epistemologically, in the order of knowing, logic is the basis for knowing God. Ontologically, in the order of being, God is the basis for knowing logic. Epistemologically, in the order of knowing, logic is the basis for knowing God. Note, God is the basis for logic, but logic is the basis for our knowledge about God. The statement, logic does not apply to God, is given as a logical, non-contradictory statement about God. You cannot possibly escape first principles of thought. Jonathan Edwards, a famous American theologian and philosopher, said first principles, if you believe in first principles, which he did, it eventually leads you to believe in God. For example, something undeniably exists. For example, I do. Number one, I undeniably exist. Two, nothing cannot cause something. It's principle number five. Nothing can only cause nothing. Nothing cannot cause something. Therefore, something exists eternally and necessarily. Now notice, in two simple steps, something exists. Jonathan Edwards, by the way, when he was a teenager, I don't know what you're doing as a teenager, but I doubt whether most of us are thinking of first principles and how it leads to God. Jonathan Edwards was an exception to that. Something undeniably exists. Nothing cannot cause something. Therefore, something eternally and necessarily exists. Notice how those two conclusions follow from these two premises. Why is it if something exists and nothing cannot cause something, that something necessarily exists? Because if nothing existed, from nothing comes nothing. Only from something comes something. So if something exists, something must exist eternally. Otherwise, nothing would be causing something. But nothing can't cause something. So if something exists now, and I do, undeniably, said Jonathan Edwards, then something must eternally exist. He proved an eternal existence from these two first principles. Something undeniably exists. Nothing can't cause something, but therefore something must always have existed. Because if something didn't always exist, then nothing could cause something. But nothing can't cause something. Therefore, something must eternally exist. Not only eternally exist, but it must necessarily exist. Why? Because if it didn't, then nothing could be the cause of something. And nothing can't be the cause of something. Therefore, by starting with the first principle of knowledge, that something exists, and the first principle of causality, that nothing can't cause something, you can prove the existence of an eternal and necessary being, i.e. God. A proof for the existence of God, probably one of the simplest, most profound, most logical principles and arguments for God ever devised. a personal, intellectual, and moral being undeniably exists. Therefore, I do. If a personal, intellectual, and moral being undeniably exists, and nothing can't cause something, then a personal, intellectual, moral, undeniable being must exist eternally. Personal, intellectual, and moral, eternal being, which we call God, exists. One of the first and profound proofs for the existence of God was Jonathan Edwards came up with when he was a teenager. Somebody a little older, a famous contemporary atheist, Anthony Flew, one of the great atheists of the 20th century, said this in his book, There is a God. It is simply inconceivable that any material matrix or field can generate a being who thinks and acts. A force field does not plan or think. So the world of living, conscious, thinking beings has an origin in a living source, a mind. And with that, the world's most famous atheist, Anthony Flew, was converted to believe in God. You can't deny God without denying that something exists and nothing cannot cause something. And if something exists and nothing can't cause something, and the something that exists is a personal, conscious, thinking being, I am a personal, conscious, thinking being, undeniably, then there must be an eternal, conscious, living being. And with that, Anthony Flew was converted to believe in the existence of God. So what's wrong with postmodernism? Well, it can't be thought consistently. You can't think it consistently. And two, it can't be spoken. You can't even speak postmodernism consistently. Example, self-defeating statement. I can't speak a word in English. Didn't he say that in English? You can't say a word in English unless you're affirming that. And if you deny it, you're denying the self-evident. I can't speak a word in English is a word spoken in English. Words cannot express meaning. That's a common belief in our postmodern world. Words cannot express meaning, certainly not properly. Then what do these words mean? If words cannot express meaning, then the very statement, words cannot express meaning, cannot mean anything. There is no objective truth. Everything is subjective. It's true for you and not for me, or true for someone else. There is no objective truth. Is that an objective truth? See, the statement, there is no objective truth, is offered as an objectively true statement. There is no objective view of history. You can't know what happened in the past. Is that an objective view of history? How can you make objective statements about the past, just history, if you're denying objective statements cannot be made about the past? There is no objective interpretation of anything. any biblical text, any literary text. There's no objective interpretation of anything. Is that an objective interpretation of something? Self-defeating statement. First principles. All knowledge is reducible to first principles. First principles are undeniable. Reductive foundationalism. The answer to postmodernism. Deconstructionism. What kind of freedom would it be, says the deconstructionists. Make the Bible mean what you want it to mean. You can deconstruct it and reconstruct it any way you want. It's called chastened epistemology. I'm probably wrong about a lot of things, but I'm sure that you're wrong about everything. And your confidence is driving me crazy. Certainty. Of course, I'm sure about some things. I never question my own doubts. Deconstructionism. It aims at something else and shoots itself. That's the dangerous weapon to have there. It kills itself in the process of trying to kill something else. That's what postmodernism does. Answering an objection that's sometimes raised. Objection. Postmodernism is not making any truth claim. They seem to try and escape the net here. It's not making any truth claim. If it's not making any truth claim, then it's not involved in a self-defeating statement. How do we respond? Then why write books? If you're not making a truth claim, why write books? C.S. Lewis says it very clearly. You can argue with a man who says rice is unwholesome, but you can never, should never argue with a man who says rice is unwholesome, but I'm not claiming this is true. I feel that this is a surrender of the claim to truth, and it has all the air of an expedient adopted at the last moment. If they do not claim to know any truth, then why don't they tell us up front? For reality, from all of these, gives us the impression that by all of the claims they are making, all of the truth claims they're making, that they really do believe they're true. Now let me explain that a little more clearly, because it's a very important point. Can the postmodernists claim not to be making a truth claim? And can he just say, I am not making a truth claim at all? Well, what are you doing? You're not making a truth claim at all. You certainly made a statement. A statement makes a declaration of some kind. How do you argue with someone like that? C.S. Lewis says, you can't argue with somebody who says, I don't like rice, or rice is not wholesome, but I'm not making a statement. There's a famous postmodernist who wrote a number of books, and in fact, if I told you who it was, it's very popular, and a shelf full of books in the bookstore under the New Age section. And he makes a statement like this. How can you make statements like this? And they said to him, if you're not making a truth claim, then what are you doing? Why are you writing? Why do you write if you're not saying something? And his answer was, the reason I write is the birds fly, Birds fly. What is that? That's just something they do. They're not making any statement. They're not making any meaning. That's just something they do. Well, if it's something they do, and it's something they say they're doing, then they're really making a statement, even if they claim they aren't making a statement. They can't even speak consistently. They can't think consistently, and they can't speak consistently. And third, they can't live consistently in a postmodern world. Francis Schaeffer said, all men constantly and consistently act as though Christianity is true. Modern men say there is no love, but only sex, but they all fall in love. Actually, every moment of his life, he is acting as though Christianity is true. And it's only the Christian system that tells him why he can and must and does act the way that he acts. It's impossible to live consistently in a postmodern worldview, because all men live as though it's not a postmodern world. Atheists admit their need for God. Even Jean-Paul Sartre said, I reached out for religion. I longed for it. It was the remedy. Had it been denied me, I would have invented it by myself. I needed the Creator, in his autobiography titled Words by Jean-Paul Sartre. Atheists like Albert Camus. First, anyone who is alone without God and without a master, the weight of days is dreadful. It's dreadful to try to live without God. It's dreadful to try to subsist in the world without God. Nietzsche, he actually wrote a poem to the unknown God. And he says halfway through, and my heart's final flame flares up for thee. Oh, come back, my unknown God, my pain, my last happiness. He's crying out to God. He could not live his atheism. Bertrand Russell, famous agnostic slash atheist, said, even when one feels nearest to others, people feel something and one seems obstinately to belong to God. And then he catches himself, at least that's how I should express it if I thought there was a God. There must be something more important, one feels, though I do not believe that there is. What an honest confession for an unbeliever. There must be something more than this life. There must be something more. But I don't believe there is. It's a choice. It's a faith that the atheist expresses. Karl Marx, I visited his tomb there outside of London a number of years ago. On the way back, I was reading the British issue of Time magazine, the European issue of Time magazine. It said this, God is dead, Marx is dead, and I'm not feeling too well either. Why? You can't live without God. Nietzsche said, I hold up before myself the images of Dante and Spinoza, who were better at accepting a lot of solitude. Of course, their way of thinking compared to mine came up with solitude, but I had none. My life now consists in the wish that it might be otherwise, and that somebody might make my truths appear incredible to me, in a letter to Overbeck. Isn't that an interesting confession? I wish I had a God for company, but I don't. And my life now consists that it might be otherwise, and that somebody might make my truths seem incredible to me. David Hume, the famous skeptic, said, most fortunately, it happens that since reason is incapable of dispelling these clouds of doubt, nature herself suffices. That purpose and it cures me of the philosophical melancholy and delirium. It drives me nuts, this atheism. I don't get any consolation from it. It drives me to melancholy and delirium. Maybe the greatest skeptic who ever lived tells where skepticism leads. He said, so what do? I dine. I play a game of backgammon. And I converse. I have a conversation with a friend. And when after 3 or 4 hours amusement, I would return to these speculations, they would appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find in my heart to enter into them further at all. He couldn't live his skepticism. Russell couldn't live his atheism. Famous atheist said, I survive morally because I retain the moral code that I was taught, along with the religion that I discarded, the religion. You and I are living on the shadow. But what will happen to our children? They're living on the shadow of a shadow. Will Durant. They couldn't live their atheism. What's wrong with humanism? What's wrong with atheism? British atheists put it well in their magazine. Humanism is almost clinically detached from life. It recommends, he does, that they develop a humanist Bible, a humanist hymnal, 10 commandments for humanists, and even confessional practices. In addition, the use of hypnotic techniques, the music and other psychological devices during humanist services would give the audience the deep spiritual experience that they would want to have. They express that in their humanist faith. In other words, make up a religion. Get yourself a hymnal. Get yourself a set of beliefs. Some hypnotic practices. And replace all of that. I decided to write some hymns for them. The wise man built his house upon the sand. My hope is built on nothing less than Jean-Paul Sartre and nothingness. Open my eyes that I may see more of my own subjectivity. Help me, Derrida, ever to be all absorbed in uncertainty. Then I'll know what it is to be lost forever in postmodernity. I don't think they'll make the hymnal. Here's how atheists evaluate atheism. Durant, and I've given the quotes previously here, is a shadow of a shadow. Nietzsche, it's not bearable. Camus, it's dreadful. Sartre, it's cruel. Hume, it leads to delirium. The main point, postmodernism, is not only unthinkable and unspeakable, but it's unlivable. The three main arguments against postmodernism. Post-foundationalism. Descartes built on a shaky foundation, and we see what happens if your life is built on a shaky foundation. Camus. Do you ever notice something about these atheists? We have given pictures of them. They're all unhappy, and they're all smoking. Nothing can discourage the appetite for divinity in the heart of man. What a confession for an atheist. Nothing can discourage the appetite for divinity in the heart of man. Pascal put it famously, from which we get the summary that he believed there is a God-sized vacuum in the human heart. What else does this craving and this helplessness proclaim but that there was once in man a true happiness of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? This he tries in vain to fill with a thousand, with infinite things. This infinite abyss, however, can be filled only with an infinite, immutable object. In other words, by God himself. What a beautiful way it has been put. You can't fill an infinite vacuum with anything but an infinite. You can't get eternal happiness with anything but the eternal. The real call for real fulfillment. Dr. Collins, who is a head of the Human Genome Project, famous Christian. Why would such a universal and unequivocal human hunger for God exist if it were not connected with any possibility for fulfillment? Creatures are not born with desires unless the satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. There's a desire for God. Well, too bad. So sad. Burma shave. Freud, theistic creator. What is the characteristic of illusion? According to Sigmund Freud in his famous book, The Future of an Illusion, that all illusions are characterized by the same thing. They are derived from human wishes. They wish it to be true, but they have no reason to believe that it's true. All religious doctrines, all of them are illusions and insusceptible of proofs. One of the greatest books on this topic was written by a famous Christian who took Freud and turned Freudianism on Freud and came to the conclusion that Freud was killing the father, and at the heart of atheism is the desire to kill God. That's what Nietzsche said. God is dead and we have killed him. Indeed, there's a coherent psychological origin to intense atheism. Therefore, in the Freudian framework, atheism is an illusion caused by the Oedipal desire to kill the father. Now, this is interesting because the common explanation for why people believe in God by an atheist is it's an illusion. It's an illusion. And they want to kill the father. Where the truth of the matter is that atheism itself is a desire to kill the father and replace the father. Sartre dismissed God. He said, I had all the more difficulty of getting rid of him in that he had installed himself at the back of my head. And I collared the Holy Ghost in the cellar and threw him out. Atheism is a cruel and long-range affair. I think I've carried it through. I lost my illusion. Unfortunately, he didn't lose. He said, I don't feel, before he died, I don't feel that I'm the product of chance, a speck of dust in the universe, but someone who was expected, prepared, prefigured, in short, a being whom only a creator could put here in the National Review. Two magazines he confessed before he died that he believed in God, he believed in the creator. The solution to postmodernism, Thomas Aquinas, An Evangelical Appraisal, a book we wrote a number of years ago that still stands. The solution to postmodernism is foundationalism, reductive foundationalism, which Aquinas taught in First Principles, which even Jonathan Edwards used to prove that there is a God. The cure for postmodernism, the vaccine of Thomism, administered by the angelic doctor. Administered what? Foundationalists. Get our book, A Systematic Theology, A Foundationalist Approach. Christian Ethics, A Foundationalist Approach. Unshakable Foundations, A Foundationalist Approach. Many other books, but if you go to the bookshelf in the back, you'll see a whole shelf full of our books, built over and over again on the only answer to postmodernism, which is foundationalism. First, self-evident, undeniable principles, which lead inevitably back to God. Evangelicals need to stop singing, should old Aquinas be forgot and never brought to mind. As the New Dictionary of Christian Apologetics puts it, there is logic and rationality because we're created in the image and likeness of God. Even the popular wisdom tells us that Christians know that you must speak, you must think, you must write, all of which are contrary to what the post-foundationalists are saying. And we can do a conclusion. How can we defend faith in a postmodern world? Answer, the same way we do it in the modern world. By logical arguments based on first principles, they come to logical conclusions. You know, it's kind of silly. We go through all these stages, all these ages, and it gets back to the same thing. They're denying man as man. They're denying there's a rational creature, a thinking creature, a speaking creature made in the image and likeness of God. We fight bad reason with good reason, not with no reason. In fact, I listened to a well-known contemporary Christian recently give a lecture on how to reach people in the postmodern world. And he did the typical thing by saying, well, they don't respond to poetry, they don't respond to art, they don't respond to this, they don't respond to that. So we've got to ignore all of that and tell them stories. And there's not a single story in his book. His entire approach to reach postmodernism was itself a modern approach. He used thoughts, he used arguments, he used reasons. And you and I, if we're going to reach the modern world, have used thoughts and reason and first principles and undeniable arguments. We've got to fight bad reason with good reason. We fight no reason with reason. Response, what reasons have we to believe in Penner's view? None. Rather than arguing for the superiority of postmodernism, he said, I assume postmodernism as a starting point and tried to make this standpoint intelligible. Page 14. He doesn't have. He's a fideist. He assumes his starting point by faith is an anti-postmodern view, and he, to no one's surprise, concludes postmodernism is the way to go. But if so, then there is no way to adjudicate conflicting views. It has numerous self-defeating claims. We can't know the objective truth. And this is an objective truth. Truth doesn't correspond to reality, and this statement corresponds to reality. The answer to postmodernism, Thomism. The angelic doctrine, back to the first principles of the Bible, back to the first principles of reason, which alone will suffice in reaching people. Let's pray. Father, I pray that as we look in this postmodern world, that we won't be faked out by fake principles that don't have a foundation to them, but that we'll return to the fundamentals. Return to the fundamentals of truth. Return to the fundamentals of thought. And that use these in reaching those who are seemingly helpless and hopeless, wandering around in the sea of subjectivity. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.